listening to the However Improbable podcast.
This week, the novella The Sign of Four by Arthur Conan Doyle is narrated for you by Paula Brett.
Chapter 7. The Episode of the Barrel. The police had brought a cab with them, and in this I escorted Miss Morstan back to her home. After the angelic fashion of women, she had borne trouble with a calm face as long as there was someone weaker than herself to support, and I had found her bright and placid by the side of the frightened housekeeper. In the cab, however, she first turned faint and then burst into a passion of weeping. So sorely had she been tried by the adventures of the night. She has told me since that she thought me cold and distant upon that journey. She little guessed the struggle within my breast, or the effort of self-restraint which held me back. My sympathies and my love went out to her, even as my hand had in the garden. I felt that years of the conventionalities of life could not teach me to know her sweet, brave nature as had this one day of strange experiences. Yet there were two thoughts which sealed the words of affection upon my lips. She was weak and helpless, shaken in mind and nerve. It was to take her at a disadvantage to obtrude love upon her at such a time. Worse still, she was rich. If Holmes's researches were successful, she would be an heiress. Was it fair? Was it honourable that a half-pay surgeon should take such advantage of an intimacy which chance had brought about? Might she not look upon me as a mere vulgar fortune-seeker? I could not bear to risk that such a thought should cross her mind. This Agra treasure intervened like an impassable barrier between us. It was nearly 2 o'clock when we reached Mrs. Cecil Forrester's. The servants had retired hours ago, but Mrs. Forrester had been so interested by the strange message which Miss Morstan had received that she had sat up in the hope of her return. She opened the door herself, a middle-aged, graceful woman, and it gave me joy to see how tenderly her arm stole round the other's waist and how motherly was the voice in which she greeted her. She was clearly no mere paid dependent, but an honoured friend. I was introduced, and Mrs. Forrester earnestly begged me to step in and tell her our adventures. I explained, however, the importance of my errand, and promised faithfully to call and report any progress which we might make with the case. As we drove away, I stole a glance back, and I still seemed to see that little group on the step, the two graceful, clinging figures, the half-opened door, the hall light shining through stained glass, the barometer and the bright stair-rods. It was soothing to catch even that passing glimpse of a tranquil English home in the midst of the wild, dark business which had absorbed us. And the more I thought of what had happened, the wilder and darker it grew. I reviewed the whole extraordinary sequence of events as I rattled on through the silent, gaslit streets. There was the original problem. That, at least, was pretty clear now. The death of Captain Morstan, the sending of the pearls, the advertisement, the letter, we had had light upon all those events. They had only led us, however, to a deeper and far more tragic mystery. The Indian treasure, the curious plan found among Morstan's baggage, the strange scene at Major Sholto's death, the rediscovery of the treasure immediately followed by the murder of the discoverer, the very singular accompaniments to the crime, the footsteps, the remarkable weapons, the words upon the card corresponding with those upon Captain Morstan's chart. Here was indeed a labyrinth in which a man less singularly endowed than my fellow lodger might well despair of ever finding a clue. Pinchin Lane was a row of shabby, two-storied brick houses in the lower quarter of Lambeth. I had to knock for some time at number 3 before I could make my impression. At last, however, there was a glint of a candle behind the blind, and a face looked out at the upper window. "Go on, you drunken vagabone!" said the face. "If you kick up any more row, I'll open the kennels and let out 43 dogs upon you." "If you'll let one out, it's just what I have come for," said I. "Go on," yelled the voice. "So help me gracious, I'll have a wiper in the bag and I'll drop it on your head if you don't hook it." "But I want a dog," I cried. "I won't be argued with," shouted Mr. Sherman. "Now stand clear, for when I say three, down goes the wiper." "Mr. Sherlock Holmes," I began, but the words had a most magical effect, for the window instantly slammed down, and within a minute the door was unbarred and open. Mr. Sherman was a lanky, lean old man with stooping shoulders, a stringy neck, and blue-tinted glasses. "A friend of Mr. Sherlock is always welcome," said he. "Step in, sir. Keep clear of the badger. Free bites. At naughty. Naughty. Would you take a nip at the gentleman?" This to a stoat which thrust its wicked head and red eyes between the bars of its cage. "Don't mind that, sir. It's only a slow worm. It ain't got no fangs, so I gives it the run of the room, for it keeps the beetles down. You must not mind me being just a little short with you at first, for I'm guyed at by the children. And there's many a one just comes down this lane to knock me up. What was it that Mr. Sherlock Holmes wanted, sir?"
"He wanted a dog of yours."
"Ah, that would be Toby."
"Yes, Toby was the name.
Toby lives at number 7 on the left here." He moved slowly forward with his candle among the queer animal family which he had gathered round him. In the uncertain, shadowy light, I could see dimly that there were glancing, glimmering eyes peeping down at us from every cranny and corner. Even the rafters above our heads were lined by solemn fowls, who lazily shifted their weight from one leg to the other as our voices disturbed their slumbers. Toby proved to be an ugly, long-haired, lop-eared creature, half spaniel and half lurcher, brown and white in colour, with a very clumsy, waddling gait. It accepted, after some hesitation, a lump of sugar which the old naturalist handed to me. Having thus sealed an alliance, it followed me to the cab and made no difficulties about accompanying me. It had just struck 3 on the palace clock when I found myself back once more at Pondicherry Lodge. The ex-prize fighter McMurdo had, I found, been arrested as an accessory, and both he and Mr. Sholto had been marched off to the station. 2 constables guarded the narrow gate, but they allowed me to pass with the dog on my mentioning the detective's name. Holmes was standing on the doorstep with his hands in his pockets, smoking his pipe.
"Ah, you have him there," said he.
"Good dog, then. Athelney Jones has gone. We have had an immense display of energy since you left. He has arrested not only friend Thaddeus, but the gatekeeper, the housekeeper, and the Indian servant. We have the place to ourselves, but for a sergeant upstairs. Leave the dog here and come up." We tied Toby to the hall table and reascended the stairs. The room was as he had left it, save that a sheet had been draped over the central figure. A weary-looking police sergeant reclined in the corner. "Lend me your bullseye, sergeant," said my companion. "Now tie this bit of card round my neck so as to hang it in front of me. Thank you. Now I must kick off my boots and stockings. Just you carry them down with you, Watson. I am going to do a little climbing. And dip my handkerchief into the creosote. That will do. Now come up into the garret with me for a moment." We clambered up through the hole. Holmes turned his light once more upon the footsteps in the dust. "I wish you particularly to notice these footmarks," he said. "Do you observe anything noteworthy about them?" "They belong," I said, "to a child or a small woman. Apart from their size, though, is there nothing else? They appear to be as much as other footmarks."
"Not at all. Look here.
This is the print of a right foot in the dust. Now I make one with my naked foot beside it. What is the chief difference? Your toes are all cramped together. The other print has each toe distinctly divided." "Quite so. That is the point. Bear that in mind. Now, would you kindly step over to that flap window and smell the edge of the woodwork? I shall stay here as I have this handkerchief in my hand." I did as he directed and was instantly conscious of a strong, tarry smell.
That is where he put his foot in getting out. If you can trace him, I should think that Toby will have no difficulty. Now, run downstairs, loose the dog, and look out for Blundin. By the time that I got out into the grounds, Sherlock Holmes was on the roof, and I could see him like an enormous glowworm crawling very slowly along the ridge. I lost sight of him behind a stack of chimneys, but he presently reappeared and then vanished once more upon the opposite side. When I made my way round there, I found him seated at one of the corner eaves.
"That you, Watson?"
he cried.
"Yes, this is the place. What is that black thing down there?"
"A water barrel."
"Top on it?"
"Yes."
"No sign of a ladder?"
"No."
"Confound the fellow. It's a most breakneck place. I ought to be able to come down where he could climb up. The water pipe feels pretty firm. Here goes, anyhow."
There was a scuffling of feet, and the lantern began to come steadily down the side of the wall. Then, with a light spring, he came down onto the barrel, and from there to the earth. "It was easy to follow him," he said, drawing on his stockings and boots. "Tiles were loosened the whole way along, and in his hurry he had dropped this. It confirms my diagnosis, as you doctors express it." The object which he held up to me was a small pocket or pouch woven out of coloured grasses and with a few tawdry beads strung round it. In shape and size it was not unlike a cigarette case. Inside were half a dozen spines of dark wood, sharp at one end and rounded at the other, like that which had struck Bartholomew Sholto. "They are hellish things," said he. "Look out that you don't prick yourself." "I'm delighted to have them, for chances are they are all he has. There is the less fear of you or me finding one in our skin before long. I would sooner face a martini bullet myself. Are you game for a 6-mile trudge, Watson?" "Certainly," I answered. "Your leg will stand it?" "Oh, yes."
"Here you are, doggy."
"Good old Toby."
"Smell it, Toby, smell it."
He pushed the creosote handkerchief under the dog's nose while the creature stood with its fluffy legs separated and with a most comical cock to its head, like a connoisseur sniffing the bouquet of a famous vintage. Holmes then threw the handkerchief to a distance, fastened a stout cord to the mongrel's collar, and led him to the foot of the water barrel. The creature instantly broke into a succession of high, tremulous yelps and, with his nose on the ground and his tail in the air, pattered off upon the trail at a pace which strained his leash and kept us at the top of our speed. The east had been gradually whitening, and we could now see some distance in the cold grey light. The square, massive house with its black, empty windows and high, bare walls towered up, sad and forlorn, behind us. Our course led right across the grounds, in and out among the trenches and pits with which they were scarred and intersected. The whole place, with its scattered dirt heaps and ill-grown shrubs, had a blighted, ill-omened look which harmonised with the black tragedy which hung over it. On reaching the boundary wall, Toby ran along, whining eagerly, underneath its shadow, and stopped finally in a corner screened by a young beech. Where the two walls joined, several bricks had been loosened, and the crevices left were worn down and rounded upon the lower side, as though they had frequently been used as a ladder. Holmes clambered up, and, taking the dog from me, he dropped it over upon the other side. "There's the print of wooden leg's hand," he remarked as I mounted up beside him. "You see the slight smudge of blood upon the white plaster? What a lucky thing it is that we have had no very heavy rain since yesterday. The scent will lie upon the road in spite of their 8-and-20 hours start." I confess that I had my doubts myself when I reflected upon the great traffic which had passed along the London road in the interval. My fears were soon appeased, however. Toby never hesitated or swerved, but waddled on in his peculiar rolling fashion. Clearly the pungent smell of the creosote rose high above all other contending scents. "Do not imagine," said Holmes, "that I depend for my success in this case upon the mere chance of one of these fellows having put his foot in the chemical. I have knowledge now which would enable me to trace them in many different ways. This, however, is the readiest, and since fortune has put it into our hands, I should be culpable if I neglected it. It has, however, prevented the case from becoming the pretty little intellectual problem which it at one time promised to be. There might have been some credit to be gained out of it, but for this too palpable clue.
There is credit, and to spare, said I.
I assure you, Holmes, that I marvel at the means by which you obtain your results in this case, even more than I did in the Jefferson Hope murder. The thing seems to me to be deeper and more inexplicable. How, for example, could you describe with such confidence the wooden-legged man?
Sure, my dear boy, it was simplicity itself. I don't wish to be theatrical.
It is all patent and above board. Two officers who are in command of a convict guard learn an important secret as to buried treasure. A map is drawn for them by an Englishman named Jonathan Small. You remember that we saw the name upon the chart in Captain Morstan's possession. He had signed it in behalf of himself and his associates, the Sign of the Four, as he somewhat dramatically called it. Aided by this chart, the officers, or one of them, gets the treasure and brings it to England, leaving, we will suppose, some condition under which he received it unfulfilled. Now, then, why did not Jonathan Small get the treasure himself? The answer is obvious. The chart is dated at a time when Morstan was brought into close association with convicts. Jonathan Small did not get the treasure because he and his associates were themselves convicts and could not get away.
But that is mere speculation, said I.
It is more than that. It is the only hypothesis which covers the facts. Let us see how it fits in with the sequel. Major Sholto remains at peace for some years, happy in the possession of his treasure. Then he receives a letter from India which gives him a great fright. What was that?
A letter to say that the men whom he had wronged had been set free?
Or had escaped. That is much more likely, for he would have known what their term of imprisonment was. It would not have been a surprise to him.
What does he do then?
He guards himself against a wooden-legged man. A white man, mark you, for he mistakes a white tradesman for him and actually fires a pistol at him. Now, only one white man's name is on the chart. The others are Hindus or Mohammedans. There is no other white man. Therefore, we may say with confidence that the wooden-legged man is identical with Jonathan Small. Does the reasoning strike you as being faulty?
No. It is clear and concise.
Well, now, let us put ourselves in the place of Jonathan Small. Let us look at it from his point of view. He comes to England with the double idea of regaining what he would consider to be his rights and of having his revenge upon the man who had wronged him. He found out where Sholto lived, and very possibly he established communications with someone inside the house. There is this butler, Lal Rao, whom we have not seen. Mrs. Bernstein gives him far from a good character. Small could not find out, however, where the treasure was hid, for no one ever knew, save the major and one faithful servant who had died. Suddenly, Small learns that the major is on his deathbed. In a frenzy lest the secret of the treasure die with him, he runs the gauntlet of the guards, makes his way to the dying man's window, and is only deterred from entering by the presence of his two sons. Mad with hate, however, against the dead man, he enters the room that night, searches his private papers in the hope of discovering some memorandum relating to the treasure, and finally leaves a memento of his visit in the short inscription upon the card. He had doubtless planned beforehand that should he slay the major, he would leave some record upon the body as a sign that it was not a common murder. But, from the point of view of the four associates, something in the nature of an act of justice. Whimsical and bizarre conceits of this kind are common enough in the annals of crime, and usually afford valuable indications as to the criminal. Do you follow all of this?
Very clearly.
Now, what could Jonathan Small do? He could only continue to keep a secret watch upon the efforts made to find the treasure. Possibly he leaves England and only comes back at intervals. Then comes the discovery of the garret, and he is instantly informed of it. We again trace the presence of some confederate in the household. Jonathan, with his wooden leg, is utterly unable to reach the lofty room of Bartholomew Sholto. He takes with him, however, a rather curious associate who gets over this difficulty but dips his naked foot into creosote. Whence comes Toby and a 6-mile limp for a half-pay officer with a damaged tendo Achilles? But it was the associate, and not Jonathan, who committed the crime. Quite so. And rather to Jonathan's disgust, to judge by the way he stamped about when he got into the room. He bore no grudge against Bartholomew Sholto, and would have preferred if he could have simply been bound and gagged. He did not wish to put his head in a halter. There was no help for it, however, and the poison had done its work. So Jonathan Small left his record, lowered the treasure box to the ground, and followed it himself. That was the train of events as far as I can decipher them. Of course, as to his personal appearance, he must be middle-aged and must be sunburned after serving his time in such an oven as the Andamans. His height is readily calculated from the length of his stride, and we know that he was bearded. His hairiness was the one point which impressed itself upon Thaddeus Sholto when he saw him at the window. I don't know that there is anything else. The associate? Ah, well, there is no great mystery in that. But you will know all about it soon enough. How sweet the morning air is! See how that one little cloud floats like a pink feather from some gigantic flamingo. Now the red rim of the sun pushes itself over the London cloud bank. It shines on a good many folk, but on none, I dare bet, who are on a stranger errand than you and I. How small we feel with our petty ambitions and strivings in the presence of the great elemental forces of nature. Are you well up in your Jean-Paul? Fairly so. I worked back to him through Carlisle. That was like following the brook to the parent lake. He makes one curious but profound remark. It is that the chief proof of man's real greatness lies in his perception of his own smallness. It argues, you see, a power of comparison and of appreciation which is in itself a proof of nobility. There is much food for thought in Richter. You have not a pistol, have you? I have my stick. It is just possible that we may need something of the sort if we get to their lair. Jonathan, I shall leave to you, but if the other turns nasty, I shall shoot him dead. He took out his revolver as he spoke, and, having loaded two of the chambers, he put it back into the right-hand pocket of his jacket. We had, during this time, been following the guidance of Toby down the half-rural, villa-lined roads which lead to the metropolis. Now, however, we were beginning to come along continuous streets where labourers and dockmen were already astir and slatternly women were taking down shutters and brushing doorsteps. At the square-topped corner public houses, business was just beginning and rough-looking men were emerging, rubbing their sleeves across their beards after their morning wet. Strange dogs sauntered up and stared wonderingly at us as we passed, but our inimitable Toby looked neither to the right nor to the left, but trotted onwards with his nose to the ground and an occasional eager whine which spoke of a hot scent. We had traversed Streatham, Brixton, Camberwell, and now found ourselves in Kennington Lane, having borne away through the side streets to the east of the Oval. The men whom we pursued seemed to have taken a curiously zigzag road with the idea probably of escaping observation. They had never kept to the main road if a parallel side street would serve their turn. At the foot of Kennington Lane, they had edged away to the left through Bond Street and Miles Street. Where the latter turns into Knight's Place, Toby ceased to advance, but began to run backwards and forwards with one ear cocked and the other drooping, the very picture of canine indecision. Then he waddled round in circles, looking up to us from time to time, as if to ask for sympathy in his embarrassment. "What the deuce is the matter with the dog?" growled Holmes. "They surely would not take a cab or go off in a balloon." "Perhaps they stood here for some time," I suggested. "Ah, it's all right. He's off again," said my companion in a tone of relief. He was indeed off, for after sniffing round again, he suddenly made up his mind and darted away with an energy and determination such as he had not yet shown. The scent appeared to be much hotter than before, for he had not even to put his nose on the ground, but tugged at his leash and tried to break into a run. I could see by the gleam in Holmes' eyes that he thought we were nearing the end of our journey. Our course now ran down Nine Elms until we came to Broderick and Nelson's large timber yard, just past the White Eagle Tavern. Here the dog, frantic with excitement, turned down through the side gate into the enclosure where the sawyers were already at work. On the dog raced through sawdust and shavings, down an alley, round a passage, between two woodpiles, and finally, with a triumphant yelp, sprang upon a large barrel which still stood upon the hand trolley on which it had been brought. With lolling tongue and blinking eyes, Toby stood upon the cask, looking from one to the other of us for some sign of appreciation. The staves of the barrel and the wheels of the trolley were smeared with a dark liquid, and the whole air was heavy with the smell of creosote. Sherlock Holmes and I looked blankly at each other, and then burst simultaneously into an uncontrollable fit of laughter. Chapter 8. The Baker Street Irregulars. "What now?" I asked. "Toby has lost his character for infallibility." "He has acted according to his lights," said Holmes, lifting him down from the barrel and walking him out of the timber yard. "If you consider how much creosote is carted about London in one day, it is no great wonder that our trails should have been crossed. It is much used now, especially for the seasoning of wood. Poor Toby is not to blame." "We must get on the main scent again, I suppose?" "Yes. And fortunately, we have no distance to go." Evidently, what puzzled the dog at the corner of Knight's Place was that there were two different trails running in opposite directions. We took the wrong one. It only remains to follow the other. There was no difficulty about this. On leading Toby to the place where he had committed his fault, he cast about in a wide circle and finally dashed off in a fresh direction. "We must take care that he does not now bring us to the place where the creosote barrel came from," I observed. "I had thought of that. But you notice that he keeps on the pavement, whereas the barrel passed down the roadway. No, we are on the true scent now." It tended down towards the riverside, running through Belmont Place and Prince's Street. At the end of Broad Street, it ran right down to the water's edge, where there was a small wooden wharf. Toby led us to the very edge of this, and there stood whining, looking out on the dark current beyond. "We are out of luck," said Holmes. "They have taken a boat here." Several small punts and skiffs were lying about in the water and on the edge of the wharf. We took Toby round each in turn, but though he sniffed earnestly, he made no sign. Close to the rude landing stage was a small brick house with a wooden placard slung out through the second window. "Mordecai Smith" was printed across it in large letters and underneath, "Boats to hire by the hour or day." A second inscription above the door informed us that a steam launch was kept, a statement which was confirmed by a great pile of coke upon the jetty. Sherlock Holmes looked slowly around, and his face assumed an ominous expression. "This looks bad," said he. "These fellows are sharper than I expected. They seem to have covered their tracks. There has, I fear, been preconcerted management here." He was approaching the door of the house when it opened, and a little curly-headed lad of 6 came running out, followed by a stoutish, red-faced woman with a large sponge in her hand. "You come back and be washed, Jack," she shouted. "Come back, you young imp, for if your father comes home and finds you like that, he'll let us hear of it." "Dear little chap," said Holmes, strategically. "What a rosy-cheeked young rascal. Now, Jack, is there anything you would like?" The youth pondered for a moment.
"I'd like a shilling," said he.
"Nothing you would like better?"
"I'd like 2 shilling better,"
the prodigy answered after some thought.
"Here you are then. Catch."
"A fine child, Mrs. Smith."
"Lord bless you, sir, he is that, and forward. He gets almost too much for me to manage, especially when my man is away days at a time."
"Away, is he?" said Holmes in a disappointed voice. I am sorry for that, for I wanted to speak to Mr. Smith.
He's been away since yesterday morning, sir, and truth to tell, I am beginning to feel frightened about him. But if it was about a boat, sir, maybe I could serve as well.
I wanted to hire his steam launch.
Why, bless you, sir, it is in the steam launch that he has gone. That's what puzzles me, for I know there ain't more coals in her that would take her to Woolwich and back. If he'd been away in the barge, I'd have thought nothing, for many a time a job has taken him as far as Gravesend, and then if there was much doing there, he might have stayed over. But what good is a steam launch without coals?
He might have bought some at a wharf down the river.
Oh, he might, sir, but it weren't his way.
Many a time I've heard him call out at the prices they charge for a few odd bags. Besides, I don't like that wooden-legged man with his ugly face and outlandish talk. What did he want always knocking about here for?
A wooden-legged man? Said Holmes with bland surprise.
Yes, sir, a brown, monkey-faced chap that's called more than once for my old man.
It was him that roused up yesternight, and, what's more, my man knew he was coming, for he had steam up in the launch. I tell you straight, sir, I don't feel easy in my mind about it.
But, my dear Mrs. Smith, said Holmes, shrugging his shoulders, you are frightening yourself about nothing. How could you possibly tell that it was the wooden-legged man who came in the night? I don't quite understand how you can be so sure.
His voice, sir. I knew his voice, which is kinda thick and foggy. He tapped at the window, about three it would be.
Show a leg, matey, says he. Time to turn out guard.
My old man woke up Jim, that's my eldest, and away they went, without so much as a word to me. I could hear the wooden leg clacking on the stones.
And was this wooden-legged man alone?
Couldn't say, I am sure, sir. I didn't hear no one else.
I am sorry, Mrs. Smith, for I wanted a steam launch, and I have heard good reports of the... Let me see, what is her name?
The Aurora, sir.
Ah, she's not that old green launch with the yellow line, very broad in the beam.
No, indeed, she's a trim as little thing as any on the river. She's been fresh painted, black with two red streaks.
Thanks. I hope you will hear soon from Mr. Smith. I am going down the river, and if I should see anything of the Aurora, I shall let him know that you are uneasy. A black funnel, you say?
No, sir, black with a white band.
Ah, of course. It was the sides which were black. Good morning, Mrs. Smith. There is a boatman here with a wherry, Watson. We shall take it and cross the river.
The main thing with people of that sort, said Holmes as we sat in the sheets of the wherry, is never to let them think that their information can be of the slightest importance to you. If you do, they will instantly shut up like an oyster. If you listen to them under protest, as it were, you are very likely to get what you want.
Our course now seems pretty clear, said I.
What would you do then?
I would engage a launch and go down the river on the track of the Aurora.
My dear fellow, it would be a colossal task. She may have touched at any wharf on either side of the stream between here and Greenwich. Below the bridge there is a perfect labyrinth of landing places for miles. It would take you days and days to exhaust them if you set about it alone.
Employ the police, then?
No. I shall probably call Athelney Jones in at the last moment. He is not a bad fellow, and I should not like to do anything which would injure him professionally. But I have a fancy for working it out myself now that we have gone so far.
Could we advertise, then, asking for information from wharfingers?
Worse and worse. Our men would know that the chase was hot at their heels and they would be off out of the country.
As it is, they are likely enough to leave, but as long as they think they are perfectly safe, they will be in no hurry. Jones's energy will be of use to us there, for his view of the case is sure to push itself into the daily press, and the runaways will think that everyone is off on the wrong scent.
What are we to do, then? I asked as we landed near Millbank Penitentiary.
Take this hansom, drive home, have some breakfast, and get an hour's sleep. It is quite on the cards that we may be afoot tonight again.
Stop at the telegraph office, cabbie!
We will keep Toby, for he may be of use to us yet. We pulled up at the Great Peter Street post office, and Holmes dispatched his wire.
Whom do you think that is to?
He asked as we resumed our journey.
I am sure I don't know.
You remember the Baker Street Division of the Detective Police Force whom I employed in the Jefferson Hope case? Well, said I, laughing, this is just the case where they might be invaluable. If they fail, I have other resources, but I shall try them first. That wire was to my dirty little Lieutenant Wiggins, and I expect that he and his gang will be with us before we have finished our breakfast. It was between 8 and 9 o'clock now, and I was conscious of a strong reaction after the successive excitements of the night. I was limp and weary, befogged in mind and fatigued in body. I had not the professional enthusiasm which carried my companion on, nor could I look at the matter as a mere abstract intellectual problem. As far as the death of Bartholomew Sholto went, I had heard little good of him, and could feel no intense antipathy to his murderers. The treasure, however, was a different matter. That, or part of it, belonged rightfully to Miss Morstan. While there was a chance of recovering it, I was ready to devote my life to the one object. True, if I found it, it would probably put her forever beyond my reach. Yet it would be a petty and selfish love which would be influenced by such a thought as that. If Holmes could work to find the criminals, I had a tenfold stronger reason to urge me on to find the treasure. A bath at Baker Street and a complete change freshened me up wonderfully. When I came down to our room, I found the breakfast laid and Holmes pouring out the coffee. "Here it is," said he, laughing and pointing to an open newspaper. "The energetic Jones and the ubiquitous reporter have fixed it up between them. But you have had enough of the case. Better have your ham and eggs first." I took the paper from him and read the short notice, which was headed, "Mysterious Business at Upper Norwood." "About 12 o'clock last night," said the Standard, "Mr. Bartholomew Sholto of Pondicherry Lodge, Upper Norwood, was found dead in his room under circumstances which point to foul play. As far as we can learn, no actual traces of violence were found upon Mr. Sholto's person, but a valuable collection of Indian gems which the deceased gentleman had inherited from his father had been carried off. The discovery was first made by Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, who had called at the house with Mr. Thaddeus Sholto, brother of the deceased. By a singular piece of good fortune, Mr. Athelney Jones, the well-known member of the Detective Police Force, happened to be at the Norwood Police Station and was on the ground within half an hour of the first alarm. His trained and experienced faculties were at once directed towards the detection of the criminals, with the gratifying results that the brother, Thaddeus Sholto, had already been arrested, together with the housekeeper, Mrs. Bernston, an Indian butler named Lal Rao, and a porter or gatekeeper named McMurdo. It is quite certain that the thief or thieves were well acquainted with the house, for Mr. Jones's well-known technical knowledge and his powers of minute observation have enabled him to prove conclusively that the miscreants could not have entered by the door or by the window, but must have made their way across the roof of the building and so through a trapdoor into a room which communicated with that in which the body was found. This fact, which has been very clearly made out, proves conclusively that it was no mere haphazard burglary. The prompt and energetic action of the officers of the law shows the great advantage of the presence on such occasions of a single vigorous and masterful mind. We cannot but think that it supplies an argument to those who would wish to see our detectives more decentralised and so brought into closer and more effective touch with the cases which it is their duty to investigate. "Isn't it gorgeous?" said Holmes, grinning over his coffee cup. "What do you think of it?" "I think that we have had a close shave ourselves of being arrested for the crime." "So do I. I wouldn't answer for our safety now if he should happen to have another of his attacks of energy." At this moment there was a loud ring at the bell, and I could hear Mrs. Hudson, our landlady, raising her voice in a wail of expostulation and dismay. "By heaven, Holmes," I said, half rising, "I believe that they are really after us." "No, it is not quite so bad as that. It is the unofficial force, the Baker Street Irregulars." As he spoke, there came a swift pattering of naked feet upon the stairs, a clatter of high voices, and in rushed a dozen dirty and ragged little street urchins. There was some show of discipline among them, despite their tumultuous entry, for they instantly drew up in line and stood facing us with expectant faces. One of their number, taller and older than the others, stood forward with an air of lounging superiority which was very funny in such a disreputable little scarecrow.
"Got your message, sir," said he, "and brought 'em on sharp. 3 bob and a tenner for tickets."
"Here you are," said Holmes, producing some silver. "In future they can report to you, Wiggins, and you to me. I cannot have the house invaded in this way. However, it is just as well that you should all hear the instructions. I want to find the whereabouts of a steam launch called the Aurora, owner Mordecai Smith, black with 2 red streaks, funnel black with a white band. She is down the river somewhere. I want 1 boy to be at Mordecai Smith's landing stage opposite Millbank to say if the boat comes back. You must divide it out among yourselves and do both banks thoroughly. Let me know the moment you have news. Is that all clear?"
"Yes, Governor," said Wiggins.
"The old scale of pay, and a guinea to the boy who finds the boat. Here's a day in advance. Now, off you go." He handed them 1 shilling each, and away they buzzed down the stairs, and I saw them a moment later streaming down the street. "If the launch is above water, they will find her," said Holmes as he rose from the table and lit his pipe. "They can go everywhere, see everything, overhear everyone. I expect to hear before evening that they have spotted her. In the meanwhile, we can do nothing but await results. We cannot pick up the broken trail until we find either the Aurora or Mr. Mordecai Smith. Toby could eat these scraps, I dare say. Are you going to bed, Holmes?" "No, I am not tired. I have a curious constitution. I never remember feeling tired by work, though idleness exhausts me completely. I am going to smoke and to think over this queer business to which my fair client has introduced us. If ever man had an easy task, this of ours ought to be. Wooden-legged men are not so common, but the other man must, I should think, be absolutely unique." "That other man again! I have no wish to make a mystery of him. To you, anyway. But you must have formed your own opinion. Now, do consider the data. Diminutive footmarks, toes never fettered by boots, naked feet, stone-headed wooden mace, great agility, small poisoned darts. What do you make of all this? Perhaps one of those Indians who were the associates of Jonathan Small?" "Hardly that," said he. "When first I saw signs of strange weapons, I was inclined to think so. But the remarkable character of the footmarks caused me to reconsider my views. Some of the inhabitants of the Indian Peninsula are small men, but none could have left such marks as that. These little darts, too, could only be shot in one way. They are from a blowpipe." "South American?" I hazarded. He stretched his hand up and took down a bulky volume from the shelf. "This is the first volume of a gazetteer which is now being published. It may be looked upon as the very latest authority. What have we here? Andaman Islands, situated 340 miles to the north of Sumatra in the Bay of Bengal. What's all this? Moist climate, coral reefs, sharks, Port Blair, convict barracks, Rutland Island, cottonwoods. Ah, here we are. The Aborigines of the Andaman Islands may perhaps claim the distinction of being the smallest race upon this earth. The average height is rather below 4 feet, although many full-grown adults may be found who are very much smaller than this. They are capable of forming most devoted friendships when their confidence has once been gained. Mark that, Watson. Now then, listen to this. Their feet and hands are remarkably small. So intractable and fierce are they that all the efforts of the British official have failed to win them over in any degree. I fancy that Jonathan Small would give a good deal not to have employed him. But how came he to have so singular a companion? Ah, that is more than I can tell. Since, however, we have already determined that Small had come from the Andamans, it is not so very wonderful that this islander should be with him. No doubt we shall know all about it in time. Look here, Watson, you look regularly done. Lie down there on the sofa and see if I can put you to sleep." He took up his violin from the corner, and as I stretched myself out, he began to play some low, dreamy, melodious air. His own, no doubt, for he had a remarkable gift for improvisation. I have a vague remembrance of his gaunt limbs, his earnest face, and the rise and fall of his bow. Then I seemed to be floated peacefully away upon a soft sea of sound until I found myself in dreamland, with the sweet face of Mary Morstan looking down upon me. Chapter 9. A Break in the Chain. It was late in the afternoon before I woke, strengthened and refreshed. Sherlock Holmes still sat exactly as I had left him, save that he had laid aside his violin and was deep in a book. He looked across at me as I stirred, and I noticed that his face was dark and troubled. "You have slept soundly," he said. "I feared that our talk would wake you." "I heard nothing," I answered. "Have you had fresh news, then?" "Unfortunately, no. I confess that I am surprised and disappointed. I expected something definite by this time. Wiggins has just been up to report. He says that no trace can be found of the launch." It is a provoking check, for every hour is of importance. Can I do anything? I am perfectly fresh now and quite ready for another night's outing. No, we can do nothing. We can only wait. If we go ourselves, the message might come in our absence and delay be caused. You can do what you will, but I must remain on guard. Then I shall run over to Camberwell and call upon Mrs. Cecil Forrester. She asked me to yesterday. "On Mrs. Cecil Forrester?" asked Holmes, with the twinkle of a smile in his eyes. "Oh, well, of course, Miss Morstan, too. They were anxious to hear what happened." "I would not tell them too much," said Holmes. "Women are never to be entirely trusted. Not the best of them. I did not pause to argue over this atrocious sentiment." "I shall be back in an hour or two," I remarked. "All right. Good luck. But I say, if you are crossing the river, you may as well return Toby, for I don't think it is at all likely that we shall have any use for him now." I took our mongrel accordingly and left him, together with a half-sovereign, at the old naturalist's in Pinchin Lane. At Camberwell I found Miss Morstan a little weary after her night's adventures, but very eager to hear the news. Mrs. Forrester, too, was full of curiosity. I told them all that we had done, suppressing, however, the more dreadful parts of the tragedy. Thus, although I spoke of Mr. Sholto's death, I said nothing of the exact manner and method of it. With all my omissions, however, there was enough to startle and amaze them. "It is a romance!" cried Mrs. Forrester. "An injured lady, a half-million in treasure, a wooden-legged ruffian? They take the place of the conventional dragon or wicked earl!" "And two knight-errants to the rescue," added Miss Morstan, with a bright glance at me. "Why, Mary, your fortune depends upon the issue of this search. I don't think that you are nearly excited enough. Just imagine what it must be to be so rich and to have the world at your feet!" It sent a little thrill of joy to my heart to notice that she showed no sign of elation at the prospect. On the contrary, she gave a toss of her proud head as though the matter were one in which she took little interest. "It is for Mr. Thaddeus Sholto that I am anxious," she said. "Nothing else is of any consequence, but I think that he has behaved most kindly and honourably throughout. It is our duty to clear him of this dreadful and unfounded charge." It was evening before I left Camberwell, and quite dark by the time I reached home. My companion's book and pipe lay by his chair, but he had disappeared. I looked about in the hope of seeing a note, but there was none. "I suppose that Mr. Sherlock Holmes has gone out?" I said to Mrs. Hudson as she came up to lower the blinds.
"No, sir, he has gone to his room, sir." "Do you know, sir," sinking her voice into an impressive whisper, "I am afraid for his health."
"Why so, Mrs. Hudson?"
"Well, he's very strange, sir. After you were gone, he walked and he walked up and down, until I was weary of the sound of his footstep. Then I heard him talking to himself and muttering, and every time the bell rang out, he came on the stairhead with, 'What is that, Mrs. Hudson?' And now he has slammed off to his room, but I can hear him walking away the same as ever. I hope he's not going to be ill, sir. I ventured to say something to him about cooling medicine, but he turned on me, sir, with such a look that I don't know how I ever got out of the room.
I don't think that you have any cause to be uneasy, Mrs. Hudson, I answered. I have seen him like this before. He has some small matter upon his mind which makes him restless. I tried to speak lightly to our worthy landlady, but I was myself somewhat uneasy when through the long night I still, from time to time, heard the dull sound of his tread and knew how his keen spirit was chafing against this involuntary inaction. At breakfast time he looked worn and haggard with a little fleck of feverish colour upon either cheek. "You are knocking yourself up, old man," I remarked. "I heard you marching about in the night."
"No, I could not sleep," he answered.
"This infernal problem is consuming me. It is too much to be balked by so petty an obstacle when all else has been overcome. I know the men, the launch, everything, and yet I can get no news. I have set other agencies at work and used every means at my disposal. The whole river has been searched on either side, but there is no news, nor has Mrs. Smith heard of her husband. I shall come to the conclusion soon that they have scuttled the craft, but there are objections to that.
Or that Mrs. Smith has put us on a wrong scent.
No, I think that may be dismissed. I had inquiries made, and there is a launch of that description.
Could it have gone up the river?
I have considered that possibility too, and there is a search party who will work up as far as Richmond. If no news comes today, I shall start off myself tomorrow and go for the men rather than the boat. But surely, surely we shall hear something.
We did not, however. Not a word came to us either from Wiggins or from the other agencies. There were articles in most of the papers upon the Norwood tragedy. They all appeared to be rather hostile to the unfortunate Thaddeus Sholto. No fresh details were to be found, however, in any of them, save that an inquest was to be held upon the following day. I walked over to Camberwell in the evening to report our ill success to the ladies, and upon my return I found Holmes dejected and somewhat morose. He would hardly reply to my questions, and busied himself all evening in an abstruse chemical analysis, which involved much heating of retorts and distilling of vapours, ending at last in a smell which fairly drove me out of the apartment. Up to the small hours of the morning I could hear the clinking of his test tubes, which told me that he was still engaged in his malodorous experiment. In the early dawn, I woke with a start, and was surprised to find him standing by my bedside, clad in a rude sailor dress with a pea jacket and a coarse red scarf round his neck. "I am off down the river, Watson," said he. "I have been turning it over in my mind, and I can see only one way out of it. It is worth trying, at all events."
"Surely I can come with you, then," said I.
"No. You can be much more useful if you will remain here as my representative. I am loath to go, for it is quite on the cards that some message may come during the day, though Wiggins was despondent about it last night. I want you to open all notes and telegrams and to act on your own judgment if any news should come. Can I rely upon you?"
"Most certainly."
"I am afraid that you will not be able to wire me, for I can hardly tell you yet where I may find myself. If I am in luck, however, I may not be gone so very long. I shall have news of some sort or other before I get back." I heard nothing of him by breakfast time. On opening the Standard, however, I found there was a fresh allusion to the business. "With reference to the Upper Norwood tragedy," it remarked, "we have reason to believe that the matter promises to be even more complex and mysterious than was originally supposed. Fresh evidence has shown that it is quite impossible that Mr. Thaddeus Sholto could have been in any way concerned in the matter. He and the housekeeper, Mrs. Bernstein, were both released yesterday evening. It is believed, however, that the police have a clue as to the real culprits, and that it is being prosecuted by Mr. Athelney Jones of Scotland Yard with all his well-known energy and sagacity. Further arrest may be expected at any moment."
"That is satisfactory, so far as it goes," thought I. "Friend Sholto is safe at any rate. I wonder what the fresh clue may be, though it seems to be a stereotyped form whenever the police have made a blunder. I tossed the paper down upon the table, but at that moment my eye caught an advertisement in the agony column. It ran this way. Lost. Whereas Mordecai Smith, boatman, and his son, Jim, left Smith's Wharf at or about 3 o'clock last Tuesday morning in the steam launch Aurora, black with two red stripes, funnel black with a white band, the sum of £5 will be paid to anyone who can give information to Mrs. Smith at Smith's Wharf or at 221B Baker Street as to the whereabouts of the said Mordecai Smith and the launch Aurora. This was clearly Holmes' doing. The Baker Street address was enough to prove that. It struck me as rather ingenious, because it might be read by the fugitives without their seeing it in more than the natural anxiety of a wife for her missing husband. It was a long day. Every time that a knock came to the door or a sharp step passed in the street, I imagined that it was either Holmes returning or an answer to his advertisement. I tried to read, but my thoughts would wander off to our strange quest and to the ill-assorted and villainous pair whom we were pursuing. Could there be, I wondered, some radical flaw in my companion's reasoning? Might he be suffering from some huge self-deception? Was it not possible that his nimble and speculative mind had built up this wild theory upon faulty premises? I had never known him to be wrong, and yet the keenest reasoner may occasionally be deceived. He was likely, I thought, to fall into error through the over-refinement of his logic. His preference for a subtle and bizarre explanation when a plainer and more commonplace one lay ready to his hand. Yet, on the other hand, I had myself seen the evidence, and I had heard the reasons for his deductions. When I looked back on the long chain of curious circumstances, many of them trivial in themselves, but all tending in the same direction, I could not disguise from myself that even if Holmes's explanation were incorrect, the true theory must be equally outré and startling. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a loud peal at the bell, an authoritative voice in the hall, and, to my surprise, no less a person than Mr. Athelney Jones was shown up to me. Very different was he, however, from the brusque and masterful professor of common sense who had taken over the case so confidently at Upper Norwood. His expression was downcast, and his bearing meek and even apologetic. "Good day, sir, good day," said he. "Mr. Sherlock Holmes is out, I understand." "Yes, and I cannot be sure when he will get back. But perhaps you would care to wait. Take that chair and try one of these cigars." "Thank you. I don't mind if I do," said he, mopping his face with a red bandana handkerchief. "And a whiskey and soda?" "Well, half a glass. It is very hot for the time of year, and I have had a good deal to worry and try me. You know my theory about this Norwood case?"
"I remember that you expressed one."
"Well, I have been obliged to reconsider it. I had my net drawn tightly round Mr. Sholto, sir, when pop he went through a hole in the middle of it. He was able to prove an alibi which could not be shaken. From the time that he left his brother's room, he was never out of sight of someone or the other, so it could not be he who climbed over the roofs and through trapdoors. It's a very dark case, and my professional credit is at the stake. I should be very glad of a little assistance."
"We all need help sometimes," said I.
"Your friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, is a wonderful man, sir," said he in a husky and confidential voice. "He's a man who's not to be beat. I have known that young man go into a good many cases, but I never saw the case yet that he could not throw a light upon. He is irregular in his methods, and a little quick, perhaps, in jumping at theories, but, on the whole, I think he would have made a most promising officer, and I don't care who knows it. I have had a wire from him this morning, by which I understand that he has got some clue to this Sholto business. Here is the message." He took the telegram out of his pocket and handed it to me. It was dated from Poplar at 12 o'clock. "Go to Baker Street at once," it said. "If I have not returned, wait for me. I am close on the track of the Sholto gang.
You can come with us tonight if you want to be in at the finish.
This sounds well. He has evidently picked up the scent again, said I.
Ah, then he has been at fault too, exclaimed Jones with evident satisfaction. Even the best of us are thrown off sometimes. Of course, this may prove to be a false alarm, but it is my duty as an officer of the law to allow no chance to slip. But there is someone at the door. Perhaps this is he.
A heavy step was heard ascending the stair with a great wheezing and rattling as from a man who was sorely put to it for breath. Once or twice he stopped, as though the climb were too much for him, but at last he made his way to our door and entered. His appearance corresponded to the sounds which we had heard. He was an aged man, clad in seafaring garb, with an old pea jacket buttoned up to his throat. His back was bowed, his knees were shaky, and his breathing was painfully asthmatic. As he leaned upon a thick oaken cudgel, his shoulders heaved in the effort to draw the air into his lungs. He had a coloured scarf round his chin, and I could see little of his face save a pair of keen, dark eyes, overhung by bushy white brows and long grey side whiskers. Altogether, he gave me the impression of a respectable master mariner who had fallen into years and poverty. "What is it, my man?" I asked. He looked about him in the slow, methodical fashion of old age.
"Is Mr. Sherlock Holmes here?"
said he.
"No, but I am acting for him. You can tell me any message you have for him."
"It was to him, himself, that I was to tell it," said he.
"But I tell you that I am acting for him. Was it about Mordecai Smith's boat?"
"Yes. I knows well where it is. And I knows where the man he is after are. And I know where the treasure is. I knows all about it."
"Then tell me, and I shall let him know."
"It was to him I was to tell it,"
he repeated with the petulant obstinacy of a very old man.
"Well, you must wait for him."
"No, no, I ain't going to lose a whole day to please no one. If Mr. Holmes ain't here, then Mr. Holmes must find it all out for himself. I don't care about the look of either of you, and I won't tell a word."
He shuffled towards the door, but Athelney Jones got in front of him.
"Wait a bit, my friend," said he. "You have important information, and you must not walk off. We shall keep you, whether you like it or not, until our friend returns."
The old man made a little run towards the door, but as Athelney Jones put his broad back up against it, he recognised the uselessness of resistance.
"Pretty sort of treatment this," he cried, stamping his stick. "I come here to see a gentleman, and you two, who I never saw in my life, seize me and treat me in this fashion."
"You will be none the worse," I said. "We shall recompense you for the loss of your time. Sit over here on the sofa, and you will not have long to wait."
He came across, sullenly enough, and seated himself with his face resting on his hands. Jones and I resumed our cigars and our talk. Suddenly, however, Holmes's voice broke in upon us.
"I think that you might offer me a cigar, too," he said.
We both started in our chairs. There was Holmes, sitting close to us with an air of quiet amusement.
"Holmes!" I exclaimed. "You here? But where is the old man?"
"Here is the old man," said he, holding out a heap of white hair. "Here he is, wig, whiskers, eyebrows and all."
"I thought my disguise was pretty good, but I hardly expected that it would stand the test."
"Ah, you rogue!" cried Jones, highly delighted.
"You would have made an actor, and a rare one. You had the proper workhouse cough, and those weak legs of yours are worth £10 a week. I thought I knew the glint of your eye, though. You didn't get away from us so easily, you see.
I have been working in that get-up all day, he said, lighting his cigar. You see, a good many of the criminal classes begin to know me, especially since our friend here took to publishing some of my cases, so I can only go on the warpath under some simple disguise like this. You got my wire?
Yes, that was what brought me here.
How has your case prospered?
It has all come to nothing. I've had to release two of my prisoners, and there is no evidence against the other two.
Never mind. We shall give you two others in the place of them, but you must put yourself under my orders. You are welcome to all the official credit, but you must act on the line that I put out. Is that agreed?
Entirely, if you will help me to the men.
Well, then. In the first place, I shall want a fast police boat, a steam launch, to be at the Westminster Stairs at 7 o'clock.
That is easily managed. There is always one about there, but I can step across the road and telephone to make sure.
Then I shall want two staunch men in case of resistance.
There will be two or three in the boat. What else?
When we secure the men, we shall get the treasure. I think that it would be a pleasure to my friend here to take the box round to the young lady, to whom half of it rightfully belongs. Let her be the first to open it. Eh, Watson?
It would be a great pleasure to me.
Rather an irregular proceeding, said Jones, shaking his head. However, the whole thing is irregular, and I suppose we must wink at it. The treasure must afterwards be handed over to the authorities until after the official investigation.
Certainly. That is easily managed. One other point. I should much like to have a few details about this matter from the lips of Jonathan Small himself. You know I like to work the detail of my cases out. There is no objection to my having an unofficial interview with him, either here in my rooms or elsewhere, as long as he is efficiently guarded.
Well, you are master of the situation. I have had no proof yet of the existence of this Jonathan Small. However, if you can catch him, I don't see how I can refuse you an interview with him.
That is understood, then.
Perfectly. Is there anything else?
Only that I insist upon your dining with us. It will be ready in a half an hour. I have oysters and a brace of grouse with something a little choice in white wines. Watson, you have never yet recognised my merits as a housekeeper.
Thanks for listening. Read more about this week's narrator in the show notes. You can send your thoughts to howeverimprobablepod@gmail.com or reach us on Twitter @improbablepod and our website howeverimprobablepodcast.com, where you can find transcripts, the research behind the episode, and suggestions for further reading. However Improbable is created by Marissa Mercurio and Sarah Kolb, with apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, dear listeners, believe us to be very sincerely yours.